Hello and welcome to another episode of the Dan Assor Show, supported by TF Connect, Tarsus Group, Terrapin and 19 Group, and the show's official venue sponsor, Carbon Neutral Conference and Exhibition Centre, BDC London, who are currently setting their sights on reaching net zero before 2030. Visit bdc.london for more information. Please check out all of my content on danassor.com and be notified first about new episodes by subscribing to my YouTube channel and by following me on Apple Podcasts and Spotify platforms.
I was going to say good morning, but obviously it's early evening over in Queensland. I believe that's where you're at.
It is 6 p.m.
Really excited to talk to you. You are my first guest over in that part of the world. I've gone to many parts of the world, but not over to Oz. So thank you for joining today. The powers and the wonders of modern technology allow us to do that. If there's someone sitting in Europe or even in the US, they don't know too much about the Australian trade show and exhibition industry. Maybe you can just give us a sort of brief overview, maybe sort of speak of the size, the scale, and those sort of things, please.
Yeah, look, I think definitely we've got a quite a healthy trade show and exhibition market here in Australia. I liken it a lot to London by size.
Okay.
You know, if you look at the population of London, I think around 8 to 9 million there. We've got Sydney with around 5 million and Melbourne with around 5 million as the two kind of major cities for trade shows in Australia. So if I liken it in terms of market opportunity, population and size, that probably is a good barometer. Probably to benefit as well, we don't have Europe a few hours away, which, you know, some of those great shows that run in Germany and beyond. So I liken it there. Major organisers that operate in this market include Terrapin, Diversified, Reed Exhibitions, Informa, Comexposium. So we're not a forgotten market, but we are a long way away. And we're also far enough away from Asia that, you know, we service the Australian market, New Zealand market, the Pacific Islands typically, but Asia is quite a way from Australia, so not a whole lot of crossover. So it kind of gives you a bit of a gauge for that.
Sure, thank you. And would I be right in assuming that the majority of activity in this area sort of fall within Melbourne and Sydney, or is that wrong? Are there other sort of venues and trade shows that happen all over the country?
Look, there's major venues in all cities, in all states, I should say, but we do... You know, we tend to see most shows follow where population and opportunity are, particularly from a trade show perspective. So Sydney and Melbourne, most shows typically operate in one market annually and may rotate each year. We're talking about the major food industry shows or gift and homeware, the typical quintessential backbone shows of trade shows gone by. But there are shows that move around when we start talking about convention space and so forth that move...
Sure.
To Adelaide, to Perth, Brisbane, much smaller populations, so more destination events, probably a little bit like you see in the States where you might see shows go to Miami things like that.
Yeah, because that's interesting because obviously the distances are fairly significant, I guess, between some states and territories. And I don't know how you found it or how people are finding it in Australia, but, you know, the bounce back post-pandemic in Europe and the US suggest that people aren't traveling as much, okay, just due to the pandemic and fears of COVID, but also because of sustainability issues and obviously trying to reduce travel. Are you finding the same within the Australian trade show and exhibition industry, that ever more sort of localized and regionalized?
Speaking to our shows, every portfolio is different. So, you know, I think if I looked at certain sectors like interior design and architecture, a higher propensity to travel because it's about trends. And if there's not going to be a show in market in your home state or city for 12 months, it's an opportunity not to miss, really. Other sectors, maybe where there's technology involved and it's not as important in terms of those decisions, they might be on a bit of a different a kilter or cycle in considering that. So I think it really depends on the sector. I would say to a degree, though, sustainability as a cause is probably less a talking point here, or less an action point, I'll say, particularly for corporate.
In terms of sort of industry associations, and we had a brief chat when we had our sort of call before this, obviously in the UK, we've got the Association of Event Organisers. Then we have the likes of UFI, who are obviously international and global. How does that work over in Australia? And I think I read recently there's going to be a merger of some of the organisations as well. Can you sort of speak to to that topic? Just give us a flavour.
So currently we have the EEAA, which is the Exhibition Events Association of Australia, about to merge, as you've highlighted, into a group with some meeting and event space and venues as well. So I know they're quite separate entities over in your part of the world. Our market's not big enough, I would say. We don't have as many organisers as you would in the UK, if I use a like-for-like on comparison. So contractors, venues, and organisers are actually all part of one association, which may strike oddly to many, because, of course, we have conflicts and challenges. But we have interest groups, special interest groups within each of those sectors. So we channel those, and then through the parent group of the association, you know, those things are lobbied and rallied and communicated, and it works quite well. So there's a bit of change with bringing some of those bodies together, but not drastic change. And I think it just gives more clout and voice to the associations and to our sector at a government level and for policy and chasing the things we need to have support.
Do you think there are sort of unique challenges of operating in your part of the world, maybe compared to other areas, specifically the States and the US or even the Middle East?
I think there's probably a few that come to mind, having seen shows in North America and Europe and also in the UK. Probably the largest one is, if you think about, if I picked a sector as an example of interior design and architecture, which I referenced before, you know, for a London show, you might have a much wider total addressable market of prospects sitting in Europe from a lighting perspective, from furniture and so forth.
Sure.
But in Australia, a long way away, we'll have a distributor that goes over and might bring 2, 3, 10, 15 brands into this country. So from an exhibition standpoint, what might have been 15 prospects for a London show is one for an Australian show.
Right.
That's a relatively big challenge. You know, if you have a distributor of key brands and they don't get the buy-in from the global company and that falls over, you've lost access to a bigger pool of product and supply. I think the other thing I'd raise is that, you know, I've seen beautiful broadloom carpet through shows in London and bright colours. We don't have access to, you've got great textiles that come out of Turkey and other regions over in Europe that help present shows well, and we don't have the same access here. So I'm sure we'll get onto it, but quite a few of our hires that have joined us from the UK of late are surprised that 1 meter by 1 meter carpet tiles are laid individually by for an entire show. That's what we do in Australia. So there's probably some differences that I'm missing as well, but those things do happen.
Can you just give us a sort of overview of the business model and the sort of core offerings in the markets that you're in, please?
Yeah, so National Media, we're a 20-year-old business. We've described ourselves often as a 20-year-old startup. And the reason for that is that we've launched and owned the shows that we run to market, and typically across the past 15 years have built those shows and sold them to the likes of Reed Exhibitions, Diversified, and taken that capital to launch new markets, new shows into new markets in this country. So we've spent a long time doing that pre-COVID. The sectors we currently play in include architecture and interior design, hotel and accommodation, which is one of our largest events. We play in marketing and e-commerce technology, fitness and wellness as well, and a few new launches coming next year as well.
Hi, I hope you enjoyed the podcast so far. Just going to take a brief pause to tell you a little bit more about our official venue sponsor, the Business Design Centre. The BDC is London's most stylish venue, playing host to hundreds of conferences and exhibitions every year. It is also the permanent home to over 125 businesses who occupy the offices and showrooms based there all year round. Opened over 36 years ago in 1986 and formerly the Royal Agricultural Hall, the building was rescued from demolition in 1981 by entrepreneur Sam Morris and was fully restored and reopened as the UK's first integrated trade exhibition and conference complex. Today, the BDC attracts almost 1 million visitors every year. Sustainability is at the forefront of everything they do at the BDC, with a goal to reach net zero before 2030. For over 13 years, it has been a certified carbon neutral venue, and the steps they have taken to improve their impact on the planet have been recognised within the events industry and further. The BDC has received recognition with multiple awards, including Exhibition News CSR Award in both 2018 and 2019, and more recently, the EN ESG Award in 2022. Please visit bdc.london for more information. Now back to the podcast.
Before we get to current day, it'd be useful to get an appreciation of sort of the pandemic and how obviously it affected your business. Now, obviously not positively, I get that, but there were different parts of the world that were more open than others. Mm-hmm. And I think you said specifically, I know you don't do the shows there, but where you're based in Queensland, you know, lockdown was sporadic, and there weren't many days that you were officially locked down. Just give us a flavour again, just looking back for people that maybe were focused quite rightly on their region and how they were doing, how the pandemic sort of manifested itself in Australia.
Look, it was, I think it was a terrible time to be an organiser in any part of the world. Sure. And that was no different here in Australia. I think the, looking back, it feels long ago. And when you look at a calendar, it wasn't that long ago.
It does. Yeah.
We are based out of Queensland, Gold Coast, Queensland in Australia. Queensland had a total of, I think, 7 or 9 days lockdown across the entire pandemic, but our border was shut to the rest of the country.
Sure.
And so Melbourne, I think, had one of the longest lockdowns in the country. Sydney had a late 150-day lockdown. So all of our shows that run in Sydney and Melbourne, the majority of our attendees, the majority of our exhibitors and sponsors and suppliers were all facing the extreme part of it. So there wasn't much benefit in all being able to sit in the office in Queensland. There wasn't a lot to be able to do. I think we didn't face too many different challenges. But from an Australian perspective, you know, the market did it quite tough. I feel like we rebounded quite quickly across as an industry, and that's a really good thing.
Sure. And correct if I'm wrong, you're a pure play B2B events. You know, a lot of organisers either had sort of media platforms in play, were already experimenting with digital, some that weren't pivoted to digital quite quickly. What was your view? How did you react? Was it something that you did? Did you turn to webinars to sort of generate revenue and keep in touch with your community? What was the overriding knee-jerk plan?
I think every organizer probably did the same thing and went, what things can we do? And so we started with a blueprint. We looked at all the digital options. We thought, you know, there's some spaces where we played where we could have become a publisher to a degree and served content. We know that many of our exhibitors were spending on digital because that's all they could do and they wanted to be present. Sure. So we contemplated that. We went deep into that process. And at the 11th hour of kind of rolling out this big digital play and platform, we took a big pivot and went, you know what, let's launch some shows and get ready for when the sun comes up. And I'm contracting the timeline on this to a degree.
Sure.
So, you know, we nurtured our existing customers, saving the relationships. That was the first part of it. But we then looked at the market and went, let's double down. So we actually exited some shows we sold some shows just prior to the pandemic, fortunately. So we went into the pandemic with one show and we came out with three and we now have five.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So, you know, I think we did our research. We spoke with stakeholders and we just said, hey, when things come good again, is there a show opportunity here for this market? And so that's why we're playing quite heavily now in interior design. We have ArchiBuild Expo in architecture and building materials, and fitness is the other place that we played. So we didn't play in those sectors at all pre-COVID. We were the first trade show to run in Australia post-pandemic, and that was the launch of our Design Show Australia product. And it was, you know, every organizer's leadership team turned up to see, will people attend? And we had masks on, we had mandates on vaccination. You know, we were running under an immense set of restrictions. And, you know, I think we delivered 8,000 or 9,000 people to that show, which was refreshing for the rest of the industry to see. So someone had to roll the dice. We were ready to do that. It was on a new product and it was to great success. So, you know, if the pandemic had have rolled on a bit longer, would we have been in the same position? You know, the roll of the dice was launch a new product, be ready. We had, you know, exhibitors at the ready, but we hadn't contracted. We had venues at the ready. We had marketing campaigns, databases built, conversations with the whole market, but with a real honesty saying, when the sun comes up, do we have an event? And look, it's served us to rebound and be in a really strong position really quickly post-pandemic, which is fortunate.
That's great. And, you know, from what people tell me, lots of panel discussions, I recently did one to a few CEOs in the States and the UK, and they tell me that, you know, the bounce and return to in-person events, which has been happening now for 18 months, has been really strong. Have you found it to be the same over there as well?
Yeah, we have. I think depending where you are in the world, but I'll speak to Australia, we saw a really rapid rebound, particularly last year. And I think there's a bit of a settling of that this year, but still extremely strong, comfortable numbers, which means we know we've got an industry, we know we've got shows, and we still know we're that amazing platform for face-to-face business being done, which is, you know, what we all live and breathe.
Sure. And in terms of building communities, so again, lots of people I speak to that they have kept apart and they understand the role of digital, so they've kept some of their platforms in place specifically to keep communicating, engaging, you know, throughout the year if they're doing an annual show. So they recognize it's not just a question of see you next year, but actually continue to speak, you know, to you throughout the year. Is that something that you do, or you literally wholly and focused on just delivering the show and then sort of back the following year? Where do you see the role of sort of event tech, digital, in supporting community relationships?
A convoluted answer for you. We are working on doing more, but we've been just so focused on our core product and growing. I think the important thing to note on that is, you know, we're not sitting on 20-year established shows. Because we've been incubating and launching new products, we've got, you know, we've got infants that are a year old. We've got, you know, juveniles at 3 years old. We've got shows at 5 years old. So each of those are at a different part of their life cycle. And typically our launches can grow at 20 to 50% year on year. So the energy that takes to do that well with community means that there's not often been time to do things, you know, year round. But as we've scaled our headcount, we're starting to look at doing that. That's through content. And honestly, it's probably about giving more than commercializing to start with. We want to give back to the industry. And there's plenty of opportunities to do that across different portfolios to varying degrees.
Sure. Thank you. And just in terms of launches, again, I like this program to be a bit educational. You've obviously had success over the years. So you spoke about 20 years of building, launching shows, then selling them, if that's, you know, what you want to achieve. And you've said, you know, you went into the pandemic with one, you've come out with multiple shows. And obviously that's to a certain extent because of your community relationships that you've built. What's behind a successful launch? What are the sort of things that you do to, you know, mitigate? Nothing's risk-free 100%, but, you know, you look at a market. What's the process? Just bring that to life.
I mean, lots of research, of course, but we start with the visitor. If you have a visitor and you know their buying intent, you have a show. So, you know, typically there's a few things. We like the number 100, whether we actually live up to this, but the 100-day sprint we do and 100 conversations with all parts of the buyer stakeholder market, small, big, corporate, SMB, and everything in between before we speak to a single supplier. We spend our time there. And we shoot as many holes in the bucket as we can. And that's how we know we've got a show. We then validate with going to the market and seeing what the commercial side of that looks like. And that's how we, in a simplistic approach, that's how we define the success or not of a show. So, and we've got a pretty good strike rate. I think we've probably had, with going to market, probably one failure in, you know, 20 plus launches.
Sure. And do you have a preferred buyer in mind before you start that process? Might seem an odd question, but you know, for a business that's got a history of launching and then selling, from an outside you could assume, well, okay, if that's was or is the strategy, then you might think, well, actually, this particular show, if we can get it to X, this company, it will fit nicely with their portfolio. Does that play into part of it?
To a degree. Pre-pandemic, absolutely. Though to our surprise, often there's been interest in several parties at the table for an acquisition, and the acquirer has not been where we thought a show could be out. This comes down to, you know, I guess market value and willingness to buy. But Yeah, in theory. Sometimes there's several several organisers that might have fit portfolios.
Sure.
But typically there has been. And look, that strategy has changed post-pandemic, but definitely in the past, in most cases, the shows have landed where we thought, but not always.
On the website, it talks about data-driven marketing products. How important is the role of data? Just sort of open question in terms of driving those decisions as to where you launch, how you promote, get people to events and so on.
I think it underpins everything, to be honest. And I think, you know, beyond data, your personalization and segmentation strategies define the success of everything we do. I think there are some shows in market that will get away for a long time with just, you know, raw, loud and proud and blasting and getting great attendance because they're great shows or they've got years of history. But there are a lot of sectors that are getting smarter and savvier. People are more valuable of their time. You mentioned sustainability and travel. So I think if you're not hitting the right people with the right message at the right time, you're really not doing best by your shows. So, you know, we spend a lot of time on data acquisition, defining them into the right buckets, but also nurturing those audiences as well. You know, once you've got the registration, I think the real work begins there.
Absolutely.
You know, someone registered 3 months out is often more dangerous. The conversion on them attending a show is up to 20% less than someone a week before. So how strong is your nurture campaign? So, you know, data tells you a lot of things. It tells us those kinds of things. It tells us where we're weak and where we need to be stronger.
Sure. Thank you. I just want to turn now attention to talent acquisition. For those that see maybe your posts and the business's posts on, say, socials like LinkedIn, you've been pretty active in taking some great talent away from UK shores. What's the sort of rationale behind that? Is it because you can't get certain staff where you are or people with certain skills? Give us a view of the strategy of sort of seeking talent from, you know, international, you know, outside of the UK, Australia.
Yeah, quite a lot of it plays into the growth strategy. So, you know, as I said, we've been a super dynamic entrepreneurial business for, you know, in my 11 years here, you know, somewhere between 10 and 14 people, lots of outside resources we'd contract in, but that's been our business size. In the last 6 months, but mainly the last 4 months, that headcount has tripled. And we wanted to bring in a leadership and an experience structure worthy of our growth plans. And if we were to do that locally, we'd be pinching from other organizers and that's not going to help the market here. And so we undertook a global campaign. The other part of it is that we're based in Queensland as a HQ. And so for us, you know, trying to get people to relocate from Sydney and Melbourne who have lives and children in schools and all those kinds of support networks is equally as challenging as convincing someone to move from London to a place that has 300 days of sunshine. So
I'm there.
so you know, it was a global campaign. We just happened to have a lot of really highly qualified and experienced applications from abroad. I think we started out with Trevor Foley and his team looking for two roles. Through interviewing, we ended up hiring a third, and since then we've found talent that are already in Australia doing other things, but again, 10, 15 years experience in the sector. I know, you know, Stephen, for example, that you've worked with in the past, and they're out here doing other things and didn't know we existed, nor the opportunity, and conversations turned into great opportunity to work together. So, you know, I think we would have currently 12 people who are of UK or international origin, and half of those we've sponsored, brought out on visas and worked with to get here. And the others were already here in other capacities, typically not with organisers, but have joined us and made the move to Queensland to join the national media business.
Sure. And, you know, if I'm based in the UK, I might have a young family. I don't know if you typically bring people without a family or you've had experience of both. It's not either way. It's not like a simple, let's just get up and go. And also you want people to commit, right? You want to know they're going to be there, especially if you're building a business for, you know, not forever, because you can't say forever, but, you know, a good few years, let's say. We convince people that it's the right thing to do.
I mean, we're really clear within that recruitment process. We're looking for people that want to be here long term.
Sure.
One, be a part of our growth journey, but two, to do that living in Australia. If that's not you, it's not worth taking any further steps. And we were really clear up front on that. And so all of a sudden you've got a really qualified application pool who want to be out here in Australia, all for varying reasons. All have moved with families. So it adds challenges, it adds timelines. But there's also something exciting about bringing your family out to, and again, I'm not trying to sell the destination, but you know, when you come to Queensland, it's, you know, it's a stunning place. It's, I don't know, 50 kilometers of golden sands and beaches. It's 300 days of sunshine. And you know, it's not a bad place to work. We get on a plane. It's 1 hour to Sydney where we run our shows. It's a lifestyle change as well as a career opportunity. And so I mate, to be honest, it hasn't been a really hard sell.
You've sold it well to anyone that's listening. Brad, I just want to focus, just turn our attentions on yourself. So it's always good to get a flavour of the individual in front of me. Tell us how you got into, I know you've been with national media for a number of years, but tell us how you got into the events and exhibitions industry.
Yeah, so someone I haven't mentioned, Mark Harvey, is the owner of National Media, and you know, the 20 years in this industry are his, and the entrepreneurial spirit and DNA is all him. I tripped into this sector. I was a marketing director for software companies, telco. I lived in London actually for a few years and ran marketing operations through Europe. And I tripped when I came back to Australia into catching up with a guy for a coffee on the Gold Coast who ran exhibitions. I'd exhibited at shows around the world, never thought about being on the other side. And Mark said to me, "You're a marketer. Why don't you come and launch a marketing show?" That's what I did 11 years ago. I launched a B2B marketing event, and next thing I was launching a cake decorating show. The next thing we launched a healthy products trade show, and I caught the bug pretty quickly. There's something exciting about the industry, but beyond that, creating something from scratch, seeing it come to fruition is really exciting. So I can't say, I still think I'm a marketer and at heart, but 11 years in exhibitions, I guess I'm an exhibition guy.
And obviously you've, I guess, risen through the ranks, my phrase, to become the CEO. What do you think are the sort of key skills and qualities that have enabled you to be successful in a business like National Media?
Look, I think, you know, cards on the table, we're a very unique business. We're all hands on. We have been, I guess we've structured and grown beyond what I'm about to describe, but we've been all hands on. So when I joined the business, I'd never picked up the phone and sold. I'd never programmed a content program. Those things kind of came quite naturally. You know, watching how Mark had done that as well was key. And, you know, it was, I don't know, I'd studied, I'd worked in retail. I don't know, marketing to marketers was a really easy start, to be honest. And that was my first gig. And, you know, in the background, we ran a facilities management show. I've always led from a sales front or a marketing standpoint with a marketing approach, which is giving value. And I guess that's kind of helped me succeed. You know, I guess work-life balance as well. But the people around me, I guess, is what I would credit to that. And maybe my experience in all past roles.
Sure. And you mentioned sort of the people around you. Obviously, we can't do this without a team. Just generally, in terms of sort of team leadership, and obviously I speak to CEOs of, you know, 1,000 people company and CEOs of 10 people companies. What do you think are the sort of main features and characteristics of a CEO and leader? What should they have to sort of foster a positive experience for people working in a company?
Look, I think you have to have an appreciation for the role that everybody does. You know, we've taken a big focus on, I like to say, hiring people that are smarter and more qualified at the roles than I. You know, I think being challenged and shown up by people that own products or own departments excites me so much. It's, you know, it's great to see. I think back in the day when we were a smaller team and we did everything, we thought we knew everything, and it's great to be challenged on that. So I think, you know, being able to accept that in an evolving business like we are is probably a key part of that leadership skill set. And also being able to work with the team to explore new ideas and new opportunities. I think, you know, We're running in a pretty typically old school industry of and way of doing things, but we've got some brilliant talent coming into our business who are not from this industry, and they ask really simple why questions that sometimes we struggle to answer. So again, I love it. It's you know, well, that's just what we've always done. And being challenged by those things is going to make our events better. It's going to make our visitor experience stronger. It's going to make our exhibitors love us even more. And I think if we can harness that, then I'm doing something right in terms of that that leadership responsibility.
Sure. Thank you. And I guess sort of final question, and I'm sure you've had many experiences. Can you think about sort of the most rewarding, memorable experience within the exhibition industry? Obviously, a role at a national media, could be a launch, could be something else. Just maybe one that sort of springs to mind.
I do. I mean, I've probably got several, and they all have the same tone. So I'll give you one. But we launched a hotel and accommodation industry trade show, and we talked to the market. We did all the things I mentioned before in launch, and a particular CEO of a major association said, "Look, we'll support you, but they won't leave their hotels. It's too hard. People have tried before. There's some great conferences already." And I said, "I just need you to support me." And I stood at the bottom of the escalators as we launched and opened the doors to that show. And I watched hoteliers come down. They'd never seen anything like this. They'd never had a trade show. And the joy of bringing that experience to people for the first time, who for years have been going to a hotel conference room, and you know, they walk into a 13,000 square meter exhibition full of products for them. It's a Westfield for them. Their eyes light up and they're a bit lost. It's pretty cool. And I caught up with the gentleman I referenced actually about a year ago, and he said, "Do you remember what I said?" He said, "Oh, gee, I was wrong. You guys have nailed it." So in a positive way, it's just great to see. Sure. You know, you don't get to do it the second year round. You get to wow people with that experience. And if we can keep improving on that, great. But there's something special about delivering a new industry that's never had a trade show or show for the first time. And we've been fortunate to do that several times.
Sure. So I think the moral of that story is, you know, back yourself. Sometimes you've got to take a leap of faith.
That's it. The 100 hoteliers told me they would come.
Brad, thank you so much for giving up your time. Really insightful. It's fascinating to hear a bit more about, obviously, national media, the Australian exhibition industry, and the fact that there's 300 days of sunshine in Queensland. So, thank you so much. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.